Pianist Gary Graffman is known to concertgoers around the world for his many recordings of major concertos, contemporary works for the left hand, and chamber music. He has also taught generations of pianists, including recent stars like Long Long and Yu Jiawang. Moviegoers know Gary Graffman for his performance on the soundtrack of Woody Allen's Manhattan, in which he played Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue with the New York Philharmonic. That performance is included in a 24-CD box set of recordings from the 1950s on, released just in time for his 85th birthday, which brings Gary Graffman to our studio. Welcome.
So happy to be with you.
That Manhattan CD is the last one in the 24-CD box set, but it is probably your best-known, most famous recording. How did you get that gig?
Well, I was with Columbia Records at that time, and Woody Allen spoke to whoever he wanted to. I have no idea to whom, or his agent did, to Columbia, and asked for a pianist for that. When they proposed me, I guess Woody Allen heard of me or something, but anyway, said okay, and that was it.
Did you know at the time that it was going to be this set to this famous opening montage of New York City?
Well, I knew it was for the movie. I knew that anything Woody Allen did, because I admired his movies, would be a success. Beyond that, no. Now, that was the best-selling record, I mean, not only of mine, which is not such a big deal, but of the New York Philharmonic, which is a big deal. And, of course, it says in huge letters, Manhattan. And then in very, very small letters, at my age, I almost need a magnifying glass for it. I think I will in a few years. It says, New York Philharmonic, Zubin Mehta, Gary Graffman.
Zubin Mehta was the conductor for that Rhapsody in Blue.
Yes.
Was Woody Allen there for the recording?
No, I met him later when it was sort of put together and so forth, and that was when I met him. I didn't then.
So he wasn't standing there saying, I want it like this, I want it like that.
No.
Because he's notorious for...
Oh, no, no.
The 24-CD set also features your performances with Leonard Bernstein and the New York Philharmonic and Charles Munch and the Boston Symphony and all kinds of others. Was there one conductor or one orchestra that you particularly connected with?
Well, it was a pleasure to play with the two you mentioned, Leonard Bernstein and Charles Munch. But actually, the one I played the most with had a reputation for being quite fierce. But I learned a lot from him every time I played with him, and I played with him a lot from the time I was 17, 18, whenever it was that I won the Levantritt competition, because that was one of the orchestras that engaged the winner of the Levantritt competition. From then on until a few months before his death, because I was his last soloist. So I played... That's George Zell. I played with him, with George Zell and the Cleveland Orchestra very many times. I mean, just practically every other year all my life. And
you say he had a reputation for being fierce, but he wasn't so fierce?
If you were well prepared. No, he had things to say to everybody. Didn't matter whether it was a young person making his debut or a very well-established artist, maybe even older than he was. I mean, when he was younger, he was also fierce. He would not agree to do anything unless he gave it 100% and was absolutely prepared and expected only exactly that from everyone else. So anyway, these orchestras, this was kind of lucky for me in that I may be the only performer of any instrument, and maybe somebody can prove me wrong, but so far we haven't found some, who has recorded with the so-called Big Five major U.S. orchestras, totally by accident, because when I was with RCA, RCA had Boston and Chicago. When I then went to Columbia Records, they had the other three of those five, Philadelphia, New York, and Cleveland. So then Sony bought both companies. So accidentally all five orchestras are represented on
and
this,
all your
including,
recording.
By the way, all in addition, the San Francisco.
And that's also how all the recordings can be boxed into one set now.
Yeah, yeah. They put out, of course, all my solo records, which had not come out, most of them had not come out on CDs before.
Is there any recording that particularly resonates with you, either you loved the music the most, or the circumstances of making it were just so sublime?
I couldn't really tell because, you know, I never listened to my recordings, frankly. And I listened to them a great deal when I made them to decide which, if we played, let's say, the first movement of whatever concerto three times. They trusted me, by the way. They sent me the reel-to-reel tapes and the music that they were using, and I marked it the way I wanted it, and they took over 90, probably 98% of my suggestions of splicing, of even balance, and so forth, because it then went to the conductor. And since all the conductors we just mentioned knew that, of course, this recording meant a great deal, it was more important to me than to Leonard Bernstein or George Sell, that I paid a huge amount of attention to it. But they listened to it then and still might have made some comments. But basically, my long answer to your short question, I listened to it so many times then that once it was done, it was a commitment. I approved it. Everybody else approved it. And really, the few things that I recorded more than once, sure, before I did it the second time, 10 years, 20 years later, I did listen to the original ones. Now I'm beginning to listen to the set, and it brings back memories. Of course, I'm listening to something that I recorded when I was 28 years old and never recorded again, although I may have obviously have played it. And it's interesting to see what I would do differently, especially now that I'm teaching. I didn't teach practically at all in my early years.
And so are there things you listen to and you go, how could that guy do that?
Well, of course, other recordings. And,
no, I mean your own recordings.
No, sometimes, yeah, that I would do it differently, or that, gee, I thought this was a little boring and it came out well, or absolutely vice versa, that here, you know, I saw this passionate thing and, well, you know, it was okay, but I would have done it more today, or less in some cases.
Now, around the time that you recorded the Rhapsody in Blue for Manhattan, you injured your hand. Yeah. And after that, you continued to play existing concertos for the left hand. And you also had contemporary works for left hand that were written specifically for you. How devastating was it before you decided to turn right-handed lemons into left-handed lemonade?
Well, no, my life changed completely at that point. But for the first year and a little bit into the second, I was going to doctors. Because, you know, maybe something can be done about it. And I also did other things. I went back I never graduated from Columbia University because I started having concerts right away. So I did like a year and a half only. So in effect, I didn't really go to college. But they allowed me to take some postgraduate courses in things that I have become very interested in, which is Asian art, so Chinese, Japanese, and Indian art history. So I did that and also read a great deal and started to go on exploratory trips to parts of Asia, including remote parts of Asia. But I was still, you know, going to doctors and thinking, well, you know, maybe it'll work out, maybe it won't. So after not that long, a year and a half anyway, it seemed, you know, nothing was getting better or worse. And that's the way it is. And there was no pain involved either, which is important. Since I had all these other interests, and I was about 50 years old, I had already played maybe 100 concerts a year for 30 years.
Time to get off that
train.
Yeah,
I couldn't say I was robbed of a career, not that I was happy about the situation. But it's not quite the same as if it had happened 15 years earlier. Then I started to teach. And both Curtis and the Manhattan School of Music. And at the Manhattan, most of my students were Curtis students who had graduated. Curtis only gives a bachelor's degree and were getting a master's or, in one case, a DMA. So they were, you know, terrific students. And Curtis, obviously, was a very small student body. It's always, you know, I think we accept less students at Curtis than, I know a percentage than Harvard does. So then after a few years of that, they asked me to be the director of Curtis and then later president, so I couldn't teach anywhere else. There wasn't time. And for 20 years, I was the head of Curtis. And this was from 1986 to 2006. And since then, through right now, although I'm no longer the head of Curtis, I'm still on the piano faculty, so I teach. and it's a pleasure to teach students of that caliber. You learn a lot yourself also.
Well, speaking of which, the Philadelphia critic Peter Dobrin, in where Curtis is located, wrote about your new box set, or wrote about you specifically with regard to that. He is rock solid, loyal to the composer, and uninterested in drawing attention to himself. In other words, Grafman could not be more different from his most eccentric pianistic progeny, Long Long. Now, I know you've been asked about this a lot, but how do you square Long Long's musical personality with what you've embodied as a musician?
Well, strange to say, well, I didn't learn this from, but I guess it rubbed off on me from my studying with Horowitz, who was somewhere, well, I don't know where to put him, but he certainly was brought huge audiences wherever he played. The reason is this. When I played for Horowitz, now I admit this was after I graduated from Curtis. I was already giving concerts, so I was sort of already formed in whatever way I was. Very late, teens, early 20s. He almost never said to me when I played for him, "I think you're on the wrong track, and I do it this way." He criticized me on the basis of what he thought I was aiming for and not succeeding, perhaps, and sort of put himself almost into what I was doing. And yeah, as if this is another idea, it's different than what I do, but it's a good idea, but it could be even better maybe this way or that way. Anyway, gave me other things to think about. The first time I ever played for him, it was a little bit of that, although it was the first time getting acquainted kind of thing. And he sent me home, lending me some recordings. This is on 78 RPM, by the way, of Battistini, a bel canto singer. Think of, you know, what if you had to sing that line, what you would do with it. And it didn't say very much else, just gave that to me. So now, in answer to what you said, I think that even without planning to do so, if I find that I have an extremely talented student, and almost everybody at Curtis is, even if they're very young. I mean, Lang Lang was 13 when he came. Yuja was 15. Hao Chen, he won the gold medal of Clyburn last time, not the last one, but the one before, 3 years ago. He was, I think, 14. The moment I have among my students is a 14, a 15, a 16. I mean, they're all, you know, young. But they have personality. They play the piano incredibly well, or they wouldn't have gotten into Curtis to start with. So that's not an issue. They have different points of view. They play different repertoire better. As students, you intentionally give them the repertoire that you think they're not playing their best because they're students, and they see what happens. But I hope that if one heard all these kids, you wouldn't know that they all had the same teacher. I hope so.
It's true. They all play very differently.
Yeah.
Did you ever talk to Long Long about his flamboyant gestures and whether they were adding something to the music?
Or the opposite.
Or the opposite?
Yes. I think on his own, actually, he's simmered down quite a lot.
Did that happen while he was studying with you? Or?
Yeah, gradually.
Yeah. Did you talk to him about handling the pressures of fame?
He is extremely well-adjusted. I'm amazed, actually. I see him very often. He lives in, obviously, a few different places, but his New York residence is across the street from me. So I see him all the time. He emails me or phones me very often. So I'm in touch with him all the time, discussing when he wants to, I mean, repertoire and such things. He's extremely well-adjusted. It's amazing that somebody in that position is as well just as he is.
I want to know what flavor vodka you're going to be celebrating your 85th birthday with.
Well, I'm very famous, by the way, for my flavored vodkas. And I used to do it. I do it to this day. But I started to before it was commercially available. Zubrovka was always available. Peretsovka was. But Peretsovka is made with the jalapeno pepper. And I make my pepper vodka with peppercorns, which I think are better. And
what?
It tastes different which kind of peppercorns you use. So I sort of, you know, I play the field sometimes this from one part of the world, sometimes from another part of the world. Recently, I started making ukrop, that's dill vodka, which is terrific, and horseradish, chrien in Russian, as well as obviously lemon, lime, tangerine. Ginger is very good. So, oh yeah, I've a rather extensive repertoire.
I understand. So, which one is going to be up at bat for
well, the? You buy a normally good vodka. You don't have to buy the Grey Goose, which costs twice as much. Let's say a Smirnoff. If I'm having them side by side, neat. Then I prefer the Grey Goose or Russian Standard, which I like, or Kettle One. I can tell the difference. If you start flavoring them, I am not able to tell the difference. I mean, unless it's some junk. But if it's a standard good vodka, that's good enough. In the case of citrus fruits, you just take the orange part of the tangerine, the green part of the lime, with a potato peeler, and put that in, because the oil of the skin is sort of taken out by the alcohol. And then you let it stay. You take about, I don't know, 6 or 8 limes. And I do it in these 1.5-liter bottles, you know.
So you put it in a separate bottle or you,
I buy the 1.5-liter, 1.75, whatever it is, liter bottles. Maybe actually 8, if it's that size, bottle of the lemon or lime or tangerine. And let it stay for 3 days. Taste it, maybe stay another half a day or maybe not, and then with a strainer, put it into another bottle and throw, you know, the empty bottle with the stuff inside away. The same with pepper, you have to be careful because it continues to get stronger and stronger. So eventually it becomes undrinkable, but not to be thrown away. Then you just use a small part of it with another bottle of vodka.
To flavor the next.
Yeah.
What a great discovery. Gary Grafman, thank you very, very much.
So nice to be with you.